Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled, How Do Buddhists Pray? And Why? By Lama Cathy Wesley. When we hear that Buddhism is a non-theistic spiritual path and hear that the Buddha denied being a deity, we might assume there's no such thing as Buddhist prayer. After all, if there are no deities in Buddhism, who would we be praying to, and why? In this talk, Lama Cathy discusses the practice of Buddhist prayer and how it can help us connect to the Buddha within. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Well, good morning, everyone. This is Lama Cathy on behalf of the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Tibetan Buddhist Meditation Center in Columbus, Ohio. And we're presenting our usual 11:30 a.m. Dharma Talk on Sunday. So I want to start by just saying hello to everyone, and I'm hoping all of you are well. And I want to give you a tiny update. The Columbus KTC Rebuilding Project continues, and this coming week we're going to be painting the shrine room. And so there's a lot of excitement going on, and I'll try to do a separate video later on, either today or tomorrow, to give you an update about all of those things. Meanwhile, today our topic is a Buddhist prayer. How do Buddhists pray and why? I am giving this talk today as a result of a conversation I was having with one of my Dharma friends who said, you know, that she had come from a Christian tradition where prayer was part of her everyday spiritual practice and wondered if there was a prayer practice in Buddhism as well. And the answer to that is, yes, there is. And but then again, for other people, when other people have asked me about this, they have made comments such as, well, there can't be prayer in Buddhism because Buddhism is a non-theistic tradition. So since Buddhism is non-theistic, where do you guys get the idea that you can pray? So so we have a lot of folks who come to Buddhism from Christianity, Judaism, or other traditions that have prayer, and they want to know why Buddhists pray if Buddha is not a god. So so I'm going to attempt to untangle that and to attempt to give you some ideas as what Buddhist prayer is all about. But here at the beginning, I'm going to start actually with a Buddhist prayer. And after I do that, I'll explain to you why I did that. So the four-line refuge prayer goes like this. In the Buddha, his teaching, and the order most excellent, I take refuge until enlightenment is reached. Through the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may we attain Buddhahood for the sake of all that lives. So that's how we begin. That's how we begin with any of our activities in Buddhist tradition, as we begin with a prayer of taking refuge. And in a few minutes, I'll explain to you why refuge and bodhicitta is usually first in mind and first in practice. So so let's start at the beginning. If Buddhism is non-theistic, then why do we pray? So let's see. I'm going to see here. Okay, yeah, that's our first topic for today. Even before the Buddha passed away 2,600 years ago in India, while he was teaching, the 45 years that he was actively teaching in northern India, people would come before him and they would bow in respect and they would place their hands together in prayer and ask him questions. They would ask his advice. They would ask him to bless them. They would make requests and so on. So even before Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha, passed away, he was actually being prayed to. And so this, of course, is can be a little bit confusing to those of us here in the West, where we usually ask questions in a straightforward way, if not perhaps a little overly direct way. And so seeing someone put their hands together and bowing, it reminds those of us who live in countries that don't have monarchs, republic countries, it makes us think, well, that's not right. In America, we stopped curtsying and bowing to monarchs back in the 18th century. And why should we bow or fold our hands in front of anyone? We're all equal. As human beings, we're all equal. Well, I guess that what happens is that human beings do want to honor those who they find to be extraordinary. And how they honor those people that they find to be extraordinary, of course, varies from culture to culture and person to person. But in India, 2,600 years ago, the way you interacted with an honored person was by bowing and by folding your hands. Sometimes in the Hindu culture, they would even touch the feet of someone who was who was an honored person. But in Buddhism, what we kept was the bowing and the folded hands. So this means that people thought of the Buddha as being special and as being a person who could grant them some kind of blessing. So that's a little bit about how prayer began in Buddhism, because it began while the Buddha was still living. My teacher, Kempo Carter Rinpoche, he was asked many times about prayer, and I did an interview with him where I asked him to explain to me the difference between Buddhist prayer and Christian prayer. And his answer was very endearing. He said, "Well," he said, "I have lived in this country in America for many years, and I've talked to lots of Christians, but," he said, "I can't really say that I truly understand Christian prayer." He said, "But let me tell you what I think it is, and then see if you think I'm right." He said, "In Christian prayer," he said, "you are praying to someone who is not like you and who you could never become like." So again, you're praying to someone who's not like you, who you could never become like. And so he said, and then secondly, he said, "You're praying for things that being has the capacity to give you." And you're basically asking for them to, I mean, he didn't use these words, but you're asking them to change reality for you. And so he said, "That's what I get out of Christian prayer." He says, "I could be wrong," but he said, as a comparison, he said, "Buddhist prayer," he said, "first of all, you're praying to someone who was once like you and who wants nothing more than for you to become like them. So you're praying to a different person. And secondly, you're praying for not for worldly things, but what you're praying for is for wisdom. You're praying for strength. You're praying for compassion and things that the Buddha or this enlightened being can help you with." So that was what he said was the difference between theistic prayer to Buddhist prayer. So that's a little bit of the background. So if what we're doing in Buddhist prayer is turning to the Buddha or into an enlightened being, then I guess we have to ask the second question, which is, who is the Buddha? And what is this enlightenment that he has? And so when the Buddha was living, of course, many people thought that he was an emanation of one of the Hindu gods. Some of them said, "Oh, are you Vishnu? Are you Shiva? Are you Krishna? Which of these Hindu gods are you?" And the Buddha Shakyamuni said, "Well, I'm none of those. I'm not a divine being." And they said, "Well, then, are you an ordinary person?" And he said, "No." He said, "I'm an enlightened person." So what he did with this answer was to differentiate between someone who is divine and someone who is ordinary. So again, the Buddhist path is sometimes, Buddhist spiritual path is sometimes called the middle way. And I think that part of the reason that the Buddhist path is called the middle way is because it is not, it lands right in the center between the two extremes. And so if the two extremes in this discussion are deity or ordinary, he's an enlightened being which comes in between. And so if we ask then the question, what is enlightenment? What is Buddhahood? And what makes the Buddha special? I think that you can understand that what makes the Buddha special is that he has broken through the confusion and delusion about the nature of mind and the nature of reality. And that as a person who has broken through the illusion and delusion, he has perfect wisdom that is unobscured, and he has perfect compassion that is unobscured. And what is it unobscured by? If we go back to the Four Noble Truths of the Buddha, his first teaching, he said, first of all, he said, suffering is part of life. You can run as fast as you can, but there will always be suffering of some kind in your life. Secondly, suffering has a cause, and that cause, he said, is not external. The cause of suffering comes from within us. It is our own grasping and clinging. We cling to people, ideas, situations, and this grasping and clinging that we exercise is the cause of all of our suffering. As Pema Chodron once said, if something hurts so much for me in my life, it's because I'm hanging on to it so tightly. So if suffering is part of life and suffering has a cause, that grasping, then what is the worst of all of our graspings? The worst of all of our graspings, according to the Buddha, is our grasping towards self, ego, me, and I, and mine. We grasp onto me, I, and mine so strongly that it causes us to actually hurt ourselves and to hurt others in order to get the things, the people, the situations, and so on, that we are grasping. So grasping is the cause of suffering, but the worst grasping of all is this grasping that is selfishness or ego fixation. And so you might think that this teaching on the Four Noble Truths is a little depressing. Suffering's part of life, and you cause it yourself through your grasping. You might think that sounds kind of hopeless, but because the suffering has a cause, the third noble truth makes sense. It says that because suffering has a cause, it does have a solution. And then finally, the solution is to break free of clinging and fixation. So these four noble truths, suffering is part of life, suffering has a cause, suffering has a solution, and there's a path that leads to the end of suffering. These four noble truths are the basic understandings that we have of the nature of mind, the nature of reality. And in fact, when people asked the historical Buddha, the Buddha Shakyamuni, well, then if you're so smart, if you have such great wisdom and you have such great compassion, then how did this world begin? And the Buddha said, well, he answered with a parable. He said, well, if I get shot with an arrow, my first thought is not going to be, I wonder what was the appearance of the face of the woman who was the mother of the person who shot me. He said, I'm going to be concerned with taking out the arrow and ending suffering. And so he said in this way, he said, my teaching, these Four Noble Truths are about suffering, its causes, and its solutions. So he declined to talk about such things, at least at that moment, he declined to talk about such things as the creation of the world and the universe and so on. By the way, spoiler alert, later on, he did go on to teach for 3 months on something called the Abhidharma, which is kind of over my head, but it's where he talks about cosmology and how our joint karma as beings brought our world into being. So he did not posit a creator of the universe, just, you know, spoiler alert, just so you know, but we can talk about Abhidharma at a later time. So this comes back to, what is enlightenment? enlightenment is this knowledge of suffering, its causes, its solution, and the path. And not just knowledge of those things, but practicing the Eightfold Noble Path, which can be summarized as do no harm, practice virtue, tame your mind. So doing no harm means don't harm yourself, don't harm others. Practice virtue means take care of yourself, benefit others. Tame your mind means to practice meditation. And through the practice of meditation, we ourselves have the potential to awaken to our own awakened Buddha nature. And that's why Kempo Kartha Rinpoche's explanation of the Buddha being someone who used to be just like us and wants us to be like them, it makes sense because the Buddha used to be an ordinary person like we are, and he became an extraordinary person, an enlightened person, and he wants us to become like that too. And what he wants for us is not just worldly requests that we might make of another type of exalted being, but he wants us to develop wisdom and compassion within ourselves. So that is what our prayer is. And that if we believe that the Buddha is enlightened, and we believe that enlightenment is possible, then that means that we also believe that enlightenment is a special state. But what kind of special state is it? Is it a state that's static? Like, does a Buddha just merely rest in enlightened understanding forever? Or is enlightenment a dynamic state in which the being who experiences enlightening is moved to help others? And according to the teachings of the Buddha in the Mahayana Sutras, the Buddha, the awakened one, is moved by compassion for other beings to not rest in nirvana, but to enter into samsara, not being attached to it, and benefiting beings to the best of their possibility. So this means that the Buddha is an awakened being who is free from confusion and delusion, and the state of enlightenment is a dynamic state in which the enlightened one reaches out and tries to benefit others. So then, that is who the Buddha is, and that is what enlightenment is. So that means that if the Buddha is an awakened being who has perfect wisdom and perfect compassion, and his state or her state is perfect action to benefit others, then it stands to reason that it's a pretty good idea to ask the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas for help. If we think that the Buddha lived just 600 years ago, and that the Buddha died, and that was the end of the Buddha, well, then not very much he could do for us now. However, the Buddha also taught that the mind is continuous. One moment of consciousness lays the basis for the next moment of consciousness, and that goes infinitely in both directions, which means that the Buddha always existed in the past and always will exist in the future and exists right now. And as such, it's fine to ask the Buddha a question anytime. And it's fine to place one's hands together and bow, showing respect to the Buddha and respectfully ask for what we need. So in a way, Buddhist prayer has been happening for 2,600 years, whether the Buddha was physically present or whether the Buddha was present in the continuum of time as a being who wants what's best for us. So I guess you could say that that being able to turn to the Buddha in moments of need is an important thing for us as human beings. It's important for us to be able to turn to someone when we feel that we're in over our heads, or that we feel that we have the need of more wisdom, if we have the need for more compassion, if we have the need to change. There's actually even prayers of Buddhist confession where we go to the Buddha as our witness and say, wow, I really messed up. and may I never mess up again, and may I benefit beings, and so on. So I think that for those of us who are trying to learn about Buddhist prayer, this gives us an idea of what Buddhist prayer is and why we do it. Now, the next question that we would deal with would be what Buddhist prayer consists of and what types of prayer are there. So when we are doing Buddhist prayer, we turn our mind to the Buddha or to another enlightened being, such as the feminine aspect of compassion, Tara, or the masculine aspect of compassion, Chenrezig. Whether we turn our minds toward the Buddha or any one of the awakened and enlightened bodhisattvas, when we turn our minds to them, what we're doing is we're kind of changing the inner atmosphere of our minds from ordinary to extraordinary. I'll give you an interesting example. Way back at the beginning of Tibetan Buddhism in America, this would have been the late 1970s, early 1980s, the previous Kalu Rinpoche came to our home monastery in Woodstock, New York, Karma Triana Dharma Chakra Monastery, and he gave a teaching. And he really, it was a teaching on Kala Chakra, a great, amazing practice of Tantra. But he didn't start by talking about the highest practices. He started talking about prayer. He started talking about how we have had confusion and delusion from the very deep past, many lifetimes, and we will have this for many future lifetimes, unless in this lifetime we take hold of the Buddha's teaching and liberate ourselves from confusion and delusion. So this was how he started his lecture, by saying our mind, our Buddha nature, our basic mind has the capacity to awaken, and that we need to have the guidance of the Buddhas to do the practices that will awaken our minds. And so that was how he started this lecture. And somebody asked him about Buddhist prayer, and he used the analogy that was available to him in the early 1980s, which was television. He said, in America, you have both radio and television. And he said, and these broadcasts come to you through invisibly through the air. And he said, there's on top of the hill, there might be a television tower or a radio tower. It's on top of the hill and it's broadcasting many hours a day, if not all day and all night. And if a person has a specific radio or television set, they can change the dials on that radio and television set to get the picture that is being broadcast from the tower. So he said, if you use this analogy to talk about the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, he said the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are present at all times, in all places, in all ways. They're always present, and they always have their mind turned toward sentient beings. It's not like you have to get their attention. But he said they're always there. They're like the radio or television tower on top of the hill, broadcasting love, wisdom, and compassion 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And that if we tune our sets to their frequency, then we'll get the picture. So in other words, when we practice Buddhist prayer, what we're doing is we're turning our mind toward enlightened beings and reflecting in our own little mind the greatness and grandeur of Buddhahood. So in a way, we're gradually changing the inner atmosphere of our mind from selfishness, self-grasping, to a more open idea of wisdom and a more open idea of love and a more open idea of compassion. So wisdom, love, and compassion is what we are reflecting inside ourselves in our inner atmosphere of mind when we turn our attention to the Buddha in prayer. So I thought that was just a magnificent a way of talking about Buddhist prayer. And I really appreciated the previous Kalu Rinpoche for giving us that example. Because if you remember from what we talked about just a few minutes ago, that we have a mind that can know itself and know itself completely. That's what Buddhahood is complete knowledge of the nature of one's own mind. But we have to work through layers of confusion and delusion in order to reach, understand, and nurture our Buddha nature. So how do we do that? How do we reach, contact, and nurture our Buddha nature? Well, through Buddhist prayer. Prayer is one of the methods. Meditation is one method. Prayer is another method. So let's talk about that for a second. I'm going to talk about the types of Buddhist prayer, such as the prayer of refuge, the prayer of bodhicitta, aspiration prayers, supplication prayers, and mantra. According to His Eminence Thaisita Rinpoche, he said, when we say the prayer of refuge, saying, I take refuge from now until enlightenment is reached, I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And that's what was reflected in the initial prayer by the words, in the Buddha, his teaching, and the order most excellent. The Buddha is the awakened one. The Dharma is his teaching. And the order most excellent is a way of talking about the Sangha, or the community of Buddhist practitioners. There are two kinds of Sangha. There's the ordinary Sangha, who are our companions along the path. And then there's the awakened Sangha of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, who are our guides. So Sitta Rinpoche said, when we turn our mind toward the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, what we are doing is we are stating our direction. We're stating that we are going to do whatever practice follows the taking of refuge. Whichever practice we do following the taking of refuge is going to be taking us toward Buddhahood. So Buddha, the statement of direction is our refuge prayer. We take refuge in the Buddha. So that's usually how Buddhist prayers begin, with some statement of refuge. In the Buddha, his teaching, and the order most excellent, we take refuge until enlightenment is reached. Through the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may we attain Buddhahood for the sake of all that lives. That first of the four lines is a statement of refuge, but the remaining three lines of that prayer are a statement of bodhicitta motivation. Bodhi means awakening, citta means mind. So bodhicitta is the mind of awakening. You could call it the mind that wants to wake up. And there are two types of bodhicitta. There's ultimate bodhicitta, which is the complete understanding of the nature of mind and the nature of phenomena. But there's also relative bodhicitta, which is love and compassion. Love and compassion is relative bodhicitta. Wisdom and understanding and emptiness and so on is the bodhicitta that is ultimate. So let's just take for a moment the relative bodhicitta for a second. In the Buddha, his teaching, and the order most excellent, I take refuge until enlightenment is reached. Until enlightenment is reached, meaning that we for now and all future lifetimes take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, meaning that we are taking refuge from the Bodhisattva point of view, not just for this life, but for always. That's the first aspect of relative bodhicitta, the length of time that we are seeking enlightenment, not just now, always. Second, through the merit of generosity and other good deeds is a way of talking about the six perfect virtues that are taught in the Mahayana Sutras. It's saying that through practicing loving kindness and compassion, but specifically talking about the six perfections, which are generosity, patience, ethics, diligence, meditation, and wisdom. So by practicing these things, we lose and gradually wear away our habits of selfishness. And as we wear away our habits of selfishness, our mind becomes more loving, more kind, and more wise. And so we take refuge from now until enlightenment is reached through the merit of generosity and other good deeds. May we attain Buddhahood for the sake of all that lives. That's the final line of that prayer. May we attain Buddhahood for the sake of all that lives is a statement of the Bodhisattva motivation. When we take the Bodhisattva vow, we vow to remain in samsara after we attain enlightenment to benefit sentient beings. So in other words, we vow to be the next group of Bodhisattvas who will be listening to and answering prayers from all human beings. So in any case, a refuge in bodhicitta is a very common prayer that's recited at the beginning of Buddhist activities. There are also other types of prayers too, such as aspiration prayers. I was going to try to share one with you today, but I haven't learned the screen sharing feature on this platform. But there's a prayer of Shantideva that is in his in the third chapter of his Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And in this prayer, he says, may I be a guide for those who are protectorless And may I be whatever they need. May I, if they need a bed, may I be a bed. May they be a boat, a raft, a bridge. May I help beings be free from suffering of all kinds. And in chapter 10 of the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, Shantideva, furthermore, makes the aspiration for as long as space endures and as long as living beings remain, until then may I too abide to dispel the suffering of the world. So these prayers of aspiration are a way of planting seeds for our future activity when we become enlightened beings. By making aspirations now, this was according to the teaching of Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, by making these aspirations now, then when we become enlightened beings, we're actually going to be able to carry them out and be present for beings in need. And Kempo Rinpoche, as you know, was a bit of a stickler for people reciting prayers in the Tibetan language, because many of our prayers were written in the Tibetan language. And he felt that since the Tibetan language was developed for the purpose of translating Dharma from Sanskrit into the language of the people, that it carried a blessing, especially since the language was developed by enlightened beings. So because of that, he felt that it was important for us to recite prayers in Tibetan. However, he said that it was important for people to understand the meanings of the words they were saying. And so understanding the meaning of the words they were saying was very important to him. So he said, when you say your aspiration prayers, he said, say them in English, because that way the aspiration goes deeper into you and it is seated there from then until enlightenment. So that's one type of prayer that we can say are these prayers of aspiration. And the other good thing about aspiration prayers is that they uplift us when we're feeling sad. I don't know about you, but sometimes I feel a little overwhelmed. I feel a little incapable. I feel a little bit like I don't know what I'm doing, and so forth and so on. But if I do an aspiration prayer, it lifts me up because it reminds me of my Buddha nature. It reminds me that I have Buddha nature and that Buddha nature has great capability. And so I encourage people who are feeling a little bit down to read some of these aspiration prayers, particularly the 10th chapter of Shantideva's A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. I ask people, just recite it out loud on a regular basis. It will help uplift you. So that's one type of prayer. Another type of prayer is a supplication prayer, where we actually go in front of an enlightened being, such as the Buddha or Tara or Chenrezig, and ask for help. There's another being that we frequently go to, and that's the Medicine Buddha. We go to the Medicine Buddha to ask for healing. We go to Tara to ask for removal of obstacles. We go to Chenrezig to ask for love. We go to Manjushri to ask for wisdom. But my teacher, Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, said, the only reason the bodhisattvas manifest this way is because we have limited minds and we think we need one Buddha to practice, one Buddha for healing and another Buddha for removal of obstacles and another Buddha for wisdom and so on. He said, it's because we have limited concrete thinking. He said, really, if you practice just one Buddha, that one Buddha will give everything to us that we need. So he said, but we have to go to that Buddha with the attitude, I know that you can help me and I want you to help me. So we can go to Medicine Buddha and ask for removal of obstacles. We can go to Manjushri and ask for more love and so forth and so on. If we practice one Buddha or Bodhisattva really, really well, it can be the focus for all of our supplications. And what are we asking for? We can ask for material things. We can say, may I have wealth. We can say, may I have compassion. May I have all of these things. But you have to remember one thing about asking for material things. Until we've accumulated a lot of merit toward having wealth, we're not actually going to get wealth just because we pray for it. We have to actually create the karmic cause for it. Because if you remember, some lectures ago, we talked about the Four Noble Truths from the point of view of action, cause, and result. That the Buddha, instead of saying that that God's caused everything or that everything was chaotic. He said, all things come from causes. So we can pray for things like health, wealth, well-being, safety, and so on. But we have to have actually accumulated the karma to have that result. The Buddha can't change our karma. But what the Buddha can do is, I guess you could say, water the seeds of our good karma. That's the way that Thupten Chodron explains it in her book. I'm trying to remember the name of her book now. I just remember the original title for it. She gave an introductory teaching on Buddhism in a book that combined two books. One of them was called Tell Me Why. So if you Google Tell Me Why by Thupten Chodron, you'll actually get probably the new version of that book with the correct title. But in that article about Buddhist prayer, Thupten Chodron says that when we pray for someone, whether it's ourselves or others, what we're really doing by turning to the Buddha and enlightened ones in prayer is that we're sort of watering the seeds of our good karma to bring them to fruition by applying applying merit or goodness to a situation. So if we supplicate and ask for things, if we have accumulated the karma for that, then those things will manifest. But we could also recognize that some of the things we pray for are not going to be what's going to happen to us. So Jamgon Kantrel the Great, in his book, his commentary, The Great Path of Awakening, he says the best way to pray is to pray to put an end to hope and fear, or anxiety and expectation. In other words, we should pray for whatever is best. We should pray for whatever is best. He goes so far in the book to say, if it's best for me to get well, I pray for the blessing of healing. If it's better for me to be ill, I pray for the blessing of illness, because illness is considered to be purifying negative karma and so on. And so he says, if we could pray with the attitude of saying, please, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, grant your blessings that that I have what is best for me and for all. Sometimes if I'm really stuck on something that I really want to have happen, I actually will pray, but I'll put that caveat in there. I'll say, I pray for this thing to happen if it is pleasing to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and if it is of benefit to myself and sentient beings. But if it's not going to please the Buddhas and it's not going to benefit sentient beings, then I don't want this thing. Because let's face it, some of the things we pray for are really not good for us. So we have to recognize that there may be a higher goodness at work in our lives. So that's a little bit about aspiration and supplication prayers. But there's also mantra, which are the names of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. The most famous mantra is the mantra of compassion, Om Mani Padme Hum, or as they pronounce it in Tibet, Om Mani Padme Hum. Om is a prayer supplicating the awakened body of the Buddha, and Hum is a prayer supplicating the awakened mind of the Buddha. Mani means jewel, and Padme means lotus. So hail or praise to the one who holds the jewel and lotus, which is a way of saying the name of Chenrezig, the one who holds a jewel, because he's depicted that way, and a lotus flower. So when we say Om Mani Padme Hum, we're calling the name of Chenrezig. And by doing that, we're creating, I guess you could say, a bit of a, remember I said that prayer was like we're reflecting the Buddha within us. We're changing our inner atmosphere to reflect our Buddha nature when we pray. Well, when we do mantra, it's the same. We're calling the name of a Buddha or Bodhisattva as a way of engendering that Buddha and Bodhisattva's realization within us. In a way, I use the tuning fork analogy. You've heard me use this one before. If we have two tuning forks tuned to the same musical note and we strike one on the table and then just hold it close to the other one, they don't even have to touch, and this one starts to vibrate in the same sound. So this idea of sympathetic vibration, which is what they call it in music science, is what happens when we recite mantra. When we recite mantra, the names of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and so on, it helps our Buddha nature to resonate, and it causes us to manifest more of the qualities of awakened beings. So that's a little bit about the type of Buddhist prayer that is mantra. That's what I have for you for today's talk, is a little bit about why and how Buddhists pray. I didn't even get into physical prayer, which many people will recognize because they see Buddhists bow, but I could say a couple words about physical prayer and about the hand gestures that get made in Vajrayana rituals. That's a way of praying using gestures. This is an offering of water and so forth. As when we imagine that we're in the presence of Buddhas, we make offerings of water and incense and so on. So all of those are physical forms of prayer. And then it even gets more interesting because in Tibet, they have prayer scrolls, which are these pictures of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas that you see here. And then they have prayer flags that carry the prayers on the wind, that the wind that goes past them is blessed, and then it touches other people. There are prayer wheels that we can spin that have prayers inside them, and the energy from that can benefit others in a positive way. And we have prayer beads that we can use to recite prayers with, saying one prayer for each bead. So there's lots of what I would call tangible prayer in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. So there's lots more to talk about. But what I'd like to do is I'd like to encourage people for the next minute or two to think about any questions they might have about Buddhist prayer and to write them in the chat or to type them in the chat. I see we have folks on Facebook today. I don't see anybody here yet from YouTube, but if you're on our Columbus KTC YouTube channel, or if you're on our Columbus KTC Facebook channel, you can go into the comments section and write a question, and I can answer that question for you. So let's take a second and take a quick look at chat and see. Oh, good. Thank you. Good to know the YouTube audience is there. Thanks for saying hey, because the streaming. Well, hi there. The streaming platform that we use, Restream, shows the comments on the side, and I had only seen things from the Facebook audience this morning. So, see if there are any questions. Oh, glad to see you all here. Thanks for saying hello to everyone in chat who's saying hi. Glad you like the talk. All right. Well, it looks like there aren't questions in the chat today, but that's okay because I'm going to make a few closing remarks here. And while I'm doing that, if you think of a question about Buddhist prayer, you can ask. I can make a few remarks. Oh, there's a question right there. Is there a Karmakaju prayer book? Yes, there is. Definitely, there is a Karmakaju prayer book, and you can order it from. Let's see if I can type it into chat. I wonder if I type in the chat, will you see it? Let's see. KTD Monastery. KTD prayer book can be ordered from now I'm going to have to find out. Namsebongso.com, I believe. So I think I typed that wrong in chat, but this way you can do a little bit of research online. At Namse Bongso, or the treasure house of the Bodhisattva Namse, is the KTD bookstore, and they actually have a prayer book called the KTD prayer book. However, let's see if I can do this for you quickly. I don't know if I can both look things up online and stay on camera. We're going to find out because I'm doing that right now. On the Columbus KTC website, we have a copy of the KTD prayer book in an 8.5 by 11 form. And that will probably be a good one for you to use, So I'm going to give you a link. Here we go. Let's see if I can make that happen. Okay. www.columbusktc.org. At our Dharma downloads page, you can actually download the KDD prayer book from there. So that's a way to get that prayer book. And it's got several different refuge prayers to choose from. It's got several different offering prayers to choose from. There may not be too many aspiration prayers in it. So for that, you have to order when you go to Namse Bangzo, Namse Bang, B-A-N-G-D-Z-O, from Namse Bangzo, you order the KTD Stupa Pilgrimage. Did I spell that? It's Pilgrimage Prayer Book. That has five major Kagyu aspiration prayers in it. And there's also a book you can order called the Kagyu Manlam Prayer Book. But that might be, I mean, this thing is like a phone book, and you'll be dazzled by the number of prayers in it. And you can get that on the website Dharma eBooks. And so if you go to the Dharma eBooks website, you're going to find lots and lots of prayer books there. So let's go back up because it looks like while I was typing those up, we got some questions. So let's see what the questions say. Oh, I'm so sorry. Comments are turned off on YouTube. I do apologize for that. I'm sorry. I didn't realize. I'll try to figure out how to do that. Okay, so here we go. Here's a person. Says my cat had rhinitis and used to slip into the attic and I'd hear him sniffling up there. Oh, that's cute. That is the origin of the screen name. That's very cute. But then somebody else is asking. Let's see if I can find the next question. Let's see. Here it is. Ooh, long question. Regarding prayer, I heard you say that when we are praying for others, we are watering our own seeds for the practice of virtue. But do you think there's also an energy that could reach others? Yeah, basically, I made a mistake if that's what I said. The proper statement about prayer is when we pray for someone, we are watering the seeds of their good karma. Now, this is because there's both causes and conditions that impact the things that happen to us in our life. Causes come from our karma, but conditions are changeable. And so we can't change our karma, but except if we do purification practice and we purify our karma through dharmic purification practices such as mantra recitation and confession and all of that. So we can actually purify our karma. And then that in effect changes it. But prayer by itself doesn't change karma. What changes karma is purification and confession practice. But conditions, on the other hand, can be impacted by prayer. In other words, when we dedicate our merit to other people, what we are doing is we're sharing our goodness. And that goodness that we are sharing with them changes the conditions that they experience. So we'll give an example. I had a friend who often was ill, but every time she got ill, people would pray for her, and maybe she would have just the right doctor walk into her room and say, here's how to solve your problem. So in other words, we didn't change her karma, but what we did do was we improved the conditions. At least she had good care, and she had good doctors and nurses and good medicine, and she was able to gradually get well. So in other words, because we are connected to people, and here's another statement. Proper statement. Interdependence which I can't spell. Interdependence is why prayer works. Prayer for others works. This, I can't remember if this was from Trungpa Rinpoche or Kempo Karta Rinpoche, but he said that because the Buddha's teaching is that all things are interdependent. That means if we have a karmic connection with someone and we pray for them, there actually is some benefit, although as unenlightened beings, we don't know what that benefit would be. But if we pray for others and we have these connections with them, this is why the prayer can be helpful to them to help adjust the conditions in which they find themselves. So let's see. Let's see what others. So that's the best answer I can give right now for the question about this. Let's see. I'm new and I need a prayer to let go of a loved one. Well, you know, I tell you what, when relationships change, it's really difficult. And there's all kinds of reasons why relationships change. Sometimes a relationship comes to an end, or sometimes the relationship's not healthy, or sometimes we have to detach from a relationship that's toxic or harmful for us. So I don't know exactly what the letting go is about here, whether it's a letting go that's grieving or if it's a letting go because the person's not good for you. But in any case, what you can do is you can actually make an aspiration prayer and make the aspiration that the person is happy wherever they are. Because if we can increase our feelings of unconditional love for someone, then we can actually allow them to be who they are and to allow them to have the life that they wish. And so I don't know that letting go of people is what you're looking for. I think what it is what we're looking to let go of is the attachment to that person that is causing us pain. So it's not that you want to let go of the person, but you want to let go of the attachment to the feelings that that person gives you, whether they're good feelings or bad feelings. You want to let go of the negative aspects of your relationship, the negative aspects, like the things that might feel good, but are actually not good for you. You might feel happy, but then you cling, it makes your clinging worse. So if you can pray, you can actually even use your own words. You can say, may my clinging for this person, or may my negative, all the negative aspects of our relationship be purified and be released. And you can also recite such things as the Chenrezig mantra, Om Mani Padme Hung, which dedicate it to the person that you're concerned about. A lot of people who are grieving say, well, how do I help the loved one who has passed away? And how do I let go of my grief? Well, the answer is, my friends who are chaplains say that grief has its own time, and you can't say, hey, it's time to stop grieving. You just change the manner of that. And sometimes in the Tibetan tradition, the 7-week period of prayer for a person who has passed away is a really good thing, because praying for that person every day for 49 days is a way of loving them from a distance and asking for a positive development in your relationship. So I apologize for not knowing quite how to answer that one. But honey, I see this one. Oh my goodness. Your son passed away. I am so, so sorry about this. I'm thinking that one of the things you can do is make this recitation of Om Mani Padme Hung every day, and you can dedicate it to your beloved. My teacher, Kempo Karta Rinpoche, said that even though a person may not have full knowledge of how to do a mantra practice, he said you can do a simplified practice, imagining that the Bodhisattva Chenrezig, who's basically, he actually looks a little similar to White Tara, who's behind me here, beautiful white in color and so on, that you imagine this white Bodhisattva over the head of the person who has passed away, and that the Bodhisattva is streaming white light upon that person, giving them everything they need, and removing everything that's harmful to them and bringing them peace. And you can do that while reciting either a short set of beads of Om Mani Padme Hum, and imagining the white light streaming on the person you love. And you can do this for people who are living or people who have passed away, or you can do an entire round, which is more than 100 of these Om Mani Padme Hums. And I would do this every day. A friend of mine lost his daughter, and it was so painful for him to lose her. And what he did was he did good deeds in her name. And this also helped. But he prayed. He did the 49 days. He prayed every day. And he said that it did help, because in a way, when they leave us at death, we think they leave us, but actually we gradually, over that period of 7 weeks, find new means of loving them through the prayers that we make and through the visualizations that we do. We find a new way to continue the beneficial aspects of our relationship through prayer. So I'll be thinking of you, and you can send me a direct message via Facebook, and we can talk more. And the person is asking for how to pray for a sick person, exactly the same. You can use the Chenrezig mantra in practice and imagine that white light from the form of Chenrezig is falling on the person who is in need of healing. Let's see if there's any. What is more important, prayer or meditation? You know, I think it's going to differ for each person. Here's the question. And I'm seeing the time. We do have about 5 more minutes, so I'll try to get to as many of these as I can. What is more important, prayer or meditation? It depends on the individual. For example, I have met people who, when they go to their Buddhist teacher instantly has them sit down and meditate right there. Saying, I'm going to teach you meditation first because that's very important for you. But you're not going to believe this. When I sat down in front of Kempo Kartha Rinpoche the first time, he taught me how to pray. That was the first teaching he gave me. What he said was, when your mind is feeling unstable or unsteady, think of the Buddha and pray to the Buddha. He didn't tell me what words to pray. He didn't tell me how. He said, think of the Buddha and pray to him. So I actually did that. So my very first practice was prayer. It could be that in his wisdom, Kempo Kartha Rinpoche saw me and saw that I came from a Christian upbringing and said, prayer is going to be her first practice. Or he said, her mind's sort of unsteady, so I think I better give her something to steady her mind. So he gave me this practice of praying to the Buddha. So I would imagine the Buddha, you know, like you see the pictures of Buddha sitting in meditation, and I would think of the Buddha and I'd see him being made of golden light and insubstantial. Because Rinpoche did say, when you visualize a Buddha, visualize that Buddha as being made of light and insubstantial. And I imagined that I was in the presence of the Buddha. And I prayed and asked for that stability that Rinpoche told me to ask for. And it was after that that he taught me meditation. So for some people, meditation is going to be the most important thing for them to do, because that is how they will steady their minds. They will steady their minds through the practice of meditation. But I think that prayer is also important, especially prayers of refuge and bodhicitta. Because if you remember from earlier in the talk, His Eminence Thaisita Rinpoche said that Buddhists always begin a session of prayer, of meditation, with refuge and bodhicitta prayers. That way they aim their meditation practice toward Buddhahood, and they aim their motivation toward the bodhisattva path. So every prayer, every period of meditation begins with a prayer, and every period of meditation ends with a prayer. I forgot to mention prayers of dedication. So prayers of dedication are a way of sealing the virtue, like sealing an envelope. It's like sealing the virtue that you've just accumulated, because a typical dedication prayer goes like this: through the merit of this practice, may all achieve Buddhahood. May it defeat our enemy, wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara. May we free all beings, may we free all beings, and so on. So dedicating the end of your meditation, you at the beginning, you do refuge, and at the end, you do dedication. And so you've got your practice of meditation bookended with prayer. So I hope that helps with your question. That's a really good one. Can you pray for a specific outcome? Of course, but you have to remember that the what we were talking about a little earlier, which was that Ajahn Chah the Great in this book says we should pray for whatever is best. And that way we are ready to accept whether to accept either outcome, either getting what we pray for or not getting what we pray for. Because if you think about Buddhism, Buddhism is like the middle path that is free from extremes. It's free from the extreme of eternalism and nihilism. It's free from the extremes of hope and fear. And by hope, I mean expectation and so forth. So yes, you definitely can pray for a specific outcome, but it might not, but you also have to pray to be able to accept any single one, any single outcome. Okay, let's see. Why does it seem that obstacles arise with greater intensity when I increase my prayer practice? Kempo Kartha Rinpoche talked about this once, and he said that in Tibet, they had a saying. He said, when you're leaving town, all of your debtors come to collect. And so what that means is that as we increase our prayers and increase our meditations and increase our practice, all of the things that are standing between us and enlightenment are going to kind of get riled up. And as a matter of fact, in Great Path of Awakening, as you get to toward the end of the book, he says, there's a particular quote here in the teachings from Serlengpa that are in this book. He said, in addition, when this is on page 46 of this book, he says, mind training, which is love and compassion practice, by itself is capable of bringing all happiness and suffering into your practice. In addition, when profound Dharma practice stirs up your evil karma from previous lifetimes, your mind is also stirred up. He says, if this kind of problem comes up, meditate in this way. And so then the prayer goes, when I am in this kind of mood, my mat is by far the best place to be. So in other words, as we do our dharmic practice, if we can see our difficulties and obstacles as being a purification of our negative karma, and that by learning how to cope with them and ride them out by using the methods of mind training, such as when we feel suffering, we don't think, oh, woe is me. We think, may my suffering contain the suffering of all sentient beings. And by my going through this moment of suffering, may I be free of it, and may all beings be free from this kind of suffering. So you can see what that does. If you say, woe is me, it increases ego fixation. You kind of go down the drain with the suffering. And if you dedicate that to the relinquishment or the releasing of suffering by yourself and all sentient beings, if you pray for it to purify your negativity and all the negativity of all sentient beings, then it actually serves that function. And I'm sorry that these things happen. Well, there's a saying in Buddhism that where there is great benefit, there's also a great obstacle. It almost arises instantly. Because as Rinpoche said, that as we're getting ready to leave samsara, all of our karmic creditors are coming to collect. In other words, all of our negative karma is going to come to fruition. He said, from the moment you take refuge until the moment you reach Buddhahood, he said, there's a lot of karma in between there that's got to be cleaned up. And it's either going to be cleaned up through experiencing obstacles and obscurations, or it's going to be cleaned up through your Dharma practice and purification. So these types of things can help. Well, golly, I didn't know that we would go the full hour, but I thank you for your patience and understanding, and I hope this has been a helpful talk for you. Because of time, there's not more to add today, but if I have some news to share with you, I'll do a Facebook Live and give you an update on things happening at KTC. So in order to complete this, remember we had, what did they say? What are the three excellences? Excellent at the beginning, excellent at the end, and excellent in the middle. Excellent in the beginning is we started with a prayer of refuge and bodhicitta. Excellent in the middle is we did our best to talk about Dharma and with a good attitude. And then finally, excellent at the end is the dedication. So I'll say a short prayer of dedication and ask you to gather together all of the goodness from this session and dedicate it to sentient beings. Through this merit, may all achieve the omniscience of Buddhahood. May it defeat our common enemy, wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may we free all beings. May we free all beings. May we free all beings. Thanks, everyone. It's really been great seeing you, and I'll see you again next month. In the meantime, please take good care, and Om Mani Padme Hum.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.